Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
46% of Americans expect to leave behind financial obligations when they pass away, so it's crucial to make sure your family is financially protected. Policy Genius helps you find the right life insurance coverage by comparing options from America's top insurers with help from licensed, award-winning agents. Secure your financial future with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com to get free life insurance quotes in just a few clicks. That's policygenius.com.
I'm Casey.
And I'm Tyler.
And you're listening to
The Element Podcast.
What's going on, all you people? Tyler's popping caps, but we ain't popping no bucks, if you know what I'm saying.
Papa Coon ain't popping no bucks.
We have been out just popping around, as they say. We've been hunting, which is cool. And, you know, the more you hunt, the more you get to hunt. So I really am trying to not kill something when we go places. I don't know if y'all figured that out this week or not, but I was real successful in my goal.
That's good. I didn't know that was your goal.
Yeah, I guess cat's out of the bag. we had a successful hunt, actually, and we'll get into that more later. But we've been down in South Texas, I guess you'd say South where we're from.
Sure.
And have been hunting some axis deer. And if you remember back in February, we did a podcast that was centered around axis deer, and we talked a lot about, you know, how they came to be in Texas and all that. If you missed that, go tune in to that. I don't remember what episode number. Tyler, you're the guy who does that pretty good.
I was when I edited the podcast, yeah. But now we've got some faithful.
There's a zebra.
Is that an eland? It's a zebra.
Yeah.
And donkeys.
And there's some black buck behind them.
About to be some zonkies.
It's dadgum just exotics paradise off down here.
They call them zonkies, right?
Whenever they make one?
Yeah. Not Debra's?
We call them Z-donks whenever I was in the business, but I think zonkies might be.
It's probably because that Trace Atkins song, Z-donk-a-zonk.
Z-donky-donk. Yeah.
That was popular at the time.
Yeah, there's some MUFON.
Man, there's stuff everywhere today.
You know, I don't know if y'all know this, but if you got a goat or a goat's
Ghost
is best animal. if you got one and it's brown, then you can call it a mouflon.
Yep.
So it's a pretty good way
of
charging more money for it.
That's a good business plan right
it
there.
It is, man. It is. I'm into it. So, anyways, we've been hunting axis, and we've been invigorated by axis since February, whenever we came down hunting them the first time.
It's the opposite of invigoration.
Short story of that is axis came here to be in Texas around 1950 or 40s or something like that at the Y.O. Ranch.
I thought it was earlier than that for some reason.
It might have been. Well, I thought they came to Hawaii way earlier. The first axis in the United States was in Hawaii.
I'll fact check for you.
Well, all that stuff is in the other podcast, right?
So yeah.
We'll make everybody do some work, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Is it devigorated? What's the opposite of invigorated?
Probably
that's what I am right now.
Uninterested.
Oh yeah.
I don't know. Uninvigorated, maybe. I don't know if I'd
use it. Invigorated.
Maybe it's one of those words where you can en and in, and it sound the same but mean different things. It's like immigrated and emigrated. Do you know the difference in those?
When you immigrate, you come in. When you emigrate, you leave.
That is correct. That is correct. I'm calling Greg Latham for some reason. Don't call me Greg. I ain't going to call you. Whoa. People passing going fast on the hill.
Not today.
Scary. Okay, so we need to kind of get this thing rolling.
We do,
because
we
got a little distracted.
Yeah. Anytime we're driving, I think you are, you know.
Well,
you
we just, got stuff to look at
I know,
right
dude.
Now.
Tell me.
And that's kind of, we can work this thing backwards, because on our drive, we're leaving right now, and on our drive, we have seen rut-raging Axis bucks twice.
Mm-hmm.
And
we saw a big buck right next to the road.
Yeah.
And he was with the doe, and there's a satellite bull that old Greg has seen.
Uh-huh.
And it was like just a freak-out session. I mean, we just couldn't believe it. In other words, we hadn't really seen many axes on this trip.
Mm-mm.
It's been tough. There's some ways. Let's talk about why. I don't know. Maybe I'm getting ahead of ourselves here, but let's talk about ways that you can do this thing, right?
That you can hunt axes.
Yeah. So you can do what we're doing is the low man on the totem pole way of doing this, right? Like we talked to a friend who talked to a friend who has some in-laws that got a place that has some axes on it, right? And then we end up hunting this place, and it's got access, but
it's an awesome property.
Yeah, oh, it's awesome.
These people
awesome
have put a ton of work
super
in.
Nice.
Yeah, they're real nice folks, and they're real interested in restoring the property to what native Texas hill country habitat looks like, which I appreciate.
Yeah. Oh, it's cool. There's like wild, Texas mountain laurel.
I saw that on the side of the road.
I got some video of that.
Good. I was
morning.
Hoping somebody did. That's the Texas state bush.
Yeah, dude. There's some of that there. And so what we're doing is hunting this property. And this time of year, last time we had, I feel like if we had the same situation as we did in February, I probably would have killed. But I don't think there was hardly any deer on the property. Greg killed one of the ones that we saw on a trail camera or on the property in daylight. Did we even see one in daylight with our naked eye outside of Greg's buck or doe?
I have not seen an axis deer on the property in person. Now, I was close to some, and we'll get into like how that came to be. But the first evening we showed up,
Greg, I'm kind of going through a point here.
Okay.
I mean, that's a one way to do it. And you can do anything in between that and, like, you know, I don't know. What's the smallest pen you've ever seen an axis in?
20 acres.
20-acre pen.
Well, I've seen them in tinies, but they don't stay there for a long time. But
yeah.
Yeah, like
To shoot an axis in a 20-acre, 8-foot high-fence pen that keeps pretty much keeps it in there, right?
Yeah.
And so you can do anything in between that. So you could hunt. I mean, what would be in between that is a place that's low-fence, but it is the heart, right? It's like probably near a river or some sort of, you know, spring-fed system of ponds or whatever
on it too.
Yeah, and has agriculture. Like those are things that would be great free range properties. And then you could hunt stuff that's like mostly high fenced or stuff that's like high fence but big acreage. And so there's a lot of ways this can be done, and most of them are more effective, if not all, than what we encountered this week for sure.
Well, that was part of the thing though. And I mean, the landowners are liable to be excited to hear that we had a hard time finding access, because one of the reasons we have permission on this place is because they're trying to restore it to native ground. And access are not native. Indeed, they are what you would call an exotic. And one of the reasons they want us to hunt is so that we can kill them and maybe in some way eradicate them, or at least extirpate them from their property. We're going to be taking a right just down here,
okay,
just so you know.
Yep, just let me know when.
Yep.
So that's kind of the idea behind how we're hunting these things. We've talked about potentially getting on a place that has a little more, it's a little more in the heart of maybe Axis Country, or has more on it. But this property has been awesome. We've gotten to hunt it by permission. I mean, that just doesn't happen, and we're super thankful for that. It's been a blessing to be able to chase them around, and probably will continue to do that as long as, you know, we don't have a whole lot of better options, which this stuff is hard to come by, right? The hill country, KC, is a, like, historically speaking, a very, very alluring area to the general population of people, right?
Yeah. So, Austin is the capital of Texas, and the Hill Country resides just west of Austin, pretty much. And it's debatable as to what the Hill Country actually is. It doesn't have true borders, you know. It's kind of just a general area of Texas. You could think of it as South Central Texas. And it's really pretty. It's rolling hills, live oaks, a few mesquites and cedars around. It's also known for its clear water streams and springs that flow, creating those clear water streams. And I do believe that is originally why people settled here. Now, I'd always heard the reason that a place like Fredericksburg is you know, renowned for its German influences, and this looked a lot like those the homeland of the Germans that were coming over here.
We're trying to navigate. I'm just going to go where Google tells me. I'm going to Marble Falls, right?
Yeah.
All right.
So Fredericksburg looked like some of those areas in Germany, and then those people knew how to do like life when they came over here, right? And one of the big things is that you have to have flowing water to operate grist mills to be able to mill grains, and that's kind of how all that got started. And that's also one of the reasons why Stephen F. Austin started the colonies there around the Austin area and a little bit east of there because of the good water. Because water, when, you know, people are settling in an area, water is the limited resource. You have to have water. You have to have it for agriculture. You have to have it for animals. You can find game also around water to feed your family. So there's like a lot of different reasons as to why you want to make sure you've got water. And that's one of the alluring things about the Hill Country, because almost every single ditch, valley, whatever you want to call it, has got clear running water, which also makes it very good habitat for a water-loving species like an axis deer. Axis deer come from India, which is, it's kind of funny how many exotics, two of the three most popular exotic animals in Texas outside of hogs, they kind of fall in their own thing, come from India. It'd be black buck, axis, and audad would be the kind of the big three there. And audad come from North Africa. But outside of that, you're looking at, you know, Indian animals. And then not far behind that is going to be the nilgai, which
also an Indian species.
An Indian species. And Tyler happened to shoot one of those recently. That video will be out fairly soon, so
yeah,
look forward to that.
Yeah, next couple years or so.
Yeah, next couple years. But that's kind of what the Hill Country is known for. And now, of course, it's known for wine country as well, which I think that just kind of developed because of the poor soils. Grapes actually do good in poor soils, and I'm not a grape expert, so find one of those if you want to know more about that.
A grape spurt.
Yeah, a grape spurt. But the clear water is fun as well, and now it's become a huge source of recreation. If you're from Texas, you know, like, floating the rivers is kind of like a Texas thing to do. People drink when they do that, or not. You just go out there with the family and just float around. I, in particular, and Tyler as well, kind of lean towards the fishing side of that stuff. We really like to fish for these native Texas species that you'll find in these rivers. So on this trip, actually, we caught some Guadalupe bass, which we say Guadalupe. And that is the Texas state fish, and they're really pretty. They look like a smallmouth that's kind of elongated. They got some really special colors if they are in good clear water, and it's cool. They'll have like some iridescent, like purpley kind of look almost to them sometimes. Really unique fish.
One that we caught yesterday had blue under its jaw, you know, kind of a blue tint to the like white under its jaw. And they'll also, in that clear water, they'll have like a, it's almost like a, you know, if you know what a largemouth kind of looks like, they have like a black spots along their lateral line in the middle. And these have like another, almost like another bar or whatever. It's not really like a bar. It's a real broken, you know, pattern that's on top as well that is you know, kind of black spotted.
Mm-hmm.
If they come out of clear water. Yesterday, you know, I think they've had quite a bit of rain here, and we were fishing somewhat kind of milky water a little bit for hill country.
I like better for fishing. Oh,
I think so too. It's usually better fishing, but mm-hmm. and we finally figured out how to make it happen and got on them pretty good, but it makes for the like a much more pale looking fish, you know, and there's mm-hmm. not a whole lot of coloration. But yeah, that was a you know, that's something that I love doing, and we actually have a video called Going for Guad, Guad being the Guadalupe bass. It was the first 4K video we ever videoed, mm-hmm. and we did we went, you know, to the Llano River and fished for Guadalupe bass and had a great time and caught a bunch of
it was cold
bass. It was cold, but we had a pretty good trip overall.
We did,
it wasn't
man.
Bad. You caught a couple of really nice ones.
We saw
nice
some axis deer on that trip as well.
Yeah. Yep.
And then also this time it was hot when we were fishing on the river. And Tyler, what did you wear fishing that day?
Well, I wore a new piece from First Light called the Trace. I wore that top. It is a I know they may or may not want this to be the practical use for it, but I think it's a great fishing shirt, man.
Well, I wore that for hunting and fishing. Actually, I didn't wear it fishing, but I wore it hunting all week. And it's probably really is the best hot weather piece of hunting gear that I've worn.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's really lightweight. It's about like wearing a Magellan shirt hunting. Pretty nice, man.
Yep.
I liked it a whole lot, and that was you know, one of the things that I did this week was test out the Trace stuff pretty hard.
I don't think I ever zipped the zipper up.
And on the chest?
The whole time I was here, dude. I wore all kinds of different Traces.
I saw you on that trail camera. You were showing the chest off pretty good.
I don't have no chest hair, but you know, I'm letting the vents open up on this trip. It was mm-hmm. it was hot, man. It was 94 to 96 most days, you know.
We had trail camera showing 118 degrees, which is kind of a misnomer because that would be like just laying in the sun basking.
Yeah.
But that'll go to show you where the animals are going to be.
Well, and
you
it's,
know.
Yeah, that's right. And it's been humid too, man. I mean, it's like.
Which is weird.
It's like upper 70s at night, you know.
This just, country ain't known for humidity, but we're in a weird weather pattern right now where it's just got that going on.
Yeah.
What is that? Is that some more exotics up here on the left? Those Nilgai?
They're looking like
no,
it,
those
aren't
are
they?
No, those are
orcs.
Orcs. So what are they called? A Gimsbuck.
Gimsbuck. That's what they are. Dadgummit. That's wild.
Are they even real? If they aren't moving.
They're not real, are they?
They are. They're just sitting real still.
Oh, look at one horn on that one.
Yeah,
it's kind of bent.
Droopy.
Those are in a pretty small enclosure, it looks
like.
Yeah,
those are pits for sure.
Yep. But anyway, so this country is awesome. I mean, we're looking at like tons of wildflowers. It's known for that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really productive landscape, like KC said. It's fed by the Edwards Aquifer that is it the largest aquifer in the world?
I don't know about that.
I feel like I've seen that before. Maybe not. Somebody fact check me on that and send us a message. But it's a huge aquifer that's like the whole central part of Texas and feeds all these streams, the San Marcos, the Guadalupe and Frio and the, you know, Nueces and all of these. I don't know it feeds all of them, but we got so many rivers in the hill country and these are spring fed, they're very consistent temperature and it's clean water. And it's a great place to live because it's pretty quick access to Austin. So you know, land prices and lease prices in this area are just outrageous in a lot of cases.
There's
man.
This thing where we'll talk about the lease stuff. Well, let's start with land, I guess, because that's more relative to everyone. Land in general is expensive because people want to get out of the cities and they want to go somewhere that's like convenient to the cities, but still be, you know, kind of have that country feel. And that's what you get in this area. And you'll find that in most urban areas out to like the two-hour radius. You know, it's like there's going to be some expensive land that doesn't make any sense for this. You know, lots are usually expensive because they a lot of times have water. You know, you're paying for neighborhood, HOA, whatever it might be. But like a lot of this stuff out here, you're paying lot prices for 100, 200, 300 acres. You know,
yeah,
like
dude.
You're in the millions real quick when it comes to acreage, and it just puts it out of reach for most people.
Well, Austin is one of the craziest, hottest markets in the U.S. right now.
Crazy fast-growing place. And
it's fast-growing. It's a happening place, right? Joe Rogan has moved down to Austin. It's kind of become like a comedy hub, and one of the most prominent programs as far as like in revenue goes is in UT is there, based there. There's live music's been, popular there for a long time. It's a happening city.
Yeah.
Got decent weather. Kind of gets hot in the summers, but like in the winters it's nice, And all of this property west of it is very much in demand, all the way out to Mexico pretty much, But obviously the closer the more more that land is valued. But like what we're looking at here from like Austin as you go west is live oaks, which are evergreen oak species. You don't see as quite as many mesquites until you get a little bit west. There's a bunch of eastern red cedar, which some of these landowners that are trying to get back to native are getting rid of, which promotes wildflowers and things and native grasses.
And even the
grasses.
Ones that aren't even worried about the native thing, eastern red cedar chokes out grass and you can't graze cattle there. So, there's war on the eastern red cedar in all of this hill country stuff. It does good in poor soils and takes over. And eastern red cedar and mesquite both because it's what they do, but they are heavy drinkers, right? So there is less groundwater, and the rivers flow less now than they used to because of the ample amount of cedar and mesquite in the hill country, whereas a live oak is very conservative when it comes to water. It doesn't use near as much water and is, better for the habitat and then produces more grass because they don't grow in such thickets. They'll have, what are the oak clumps called? Mott. There'll be motts of live oaks, but it doesn't just take over, It's a slower growing plant, so you end up with this savanna look, which is what this stuff's supposed to look like.
Mm-hmm. Which, in those savanna look areas, some of these more herd-type species that you see that have been brought in, these exotic species, thrive in this stuff, right? Which is why the axis now free ranges all over a big part of Texas. And it's the reason we're down here hunting. Because there's an opportunity to hunt axis deer doing what in June?
Supposedly rutting. They are rutting in June. Now, I don't know what that looks like exactly for axis, because I have not had enough experience with it. But
it seems like they might be somewhat like elk.
The weird thing with an axis is that it's not like a whitetail where there is a specific rut window. It's more of a elevated level of the rut because they rut year-round. The reason they can survive in this area is because it doesn't get too cold in the Texas Hill Country in south. If you go too far south, there's not enough water for them. They can't survive either. So this is like the spot, right? And so what that means, where they are from in India, is a tropical and subtropical climate, which is consistent, which means that they don't have like a yearly cycle for their rut. So at any point in time, you will have does that are in estrus, which means that they are breedable, and you'll have bucks that go through a yearly antler cycle where they are in rut, or musk, I believe it's called, whenever you are in Asia or Africa, and they'll go in and out of that. So at any point in time, there's rut action going on.
Mm-hmm.
But supposedly, because May and June are wet and hot, that's like when there's the most rut happening.
Yeah. So we were running some Moultrie cameras that had velvet bucks and hardhorn bucks on them both. And that's what you see most times of the year is some ratio of that going on. When we were here in February, there's a lot of bucks that had just shed and started growing back. So we had these little bitty, just knobbed, velvet heads coming in and out. And then I also found a shed that was fresh off of what we think was a buck you saw. That was a half rack, right?
I saw a half rack, and I don't know if it was his or not, but he was occupying the same area, so it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So
and it's big.
Yeah, it's awesome. And so that's that's what we've, you know, that's kind of what you're dealing with, is you always could have a buck come in at any time of year that's just shed, mm-hmm. you know what I mean, or and is half grown.
Bucks do this thing, it's called a roar, where, and it's kind of like what you said earlier, you compared them to elk. They kind of do that. They have these herds or harems, and they'll be like a mature buck with a bunch of does, and they'll be like younger bucks that are kind of satellite style around them as well. And those bucks, I haven't got to observe it like in person, but you hear it, and it's a three note thing. It's raw, raw, raw. And that's like, I don't think they do that if they are not feeling ruddy. So like, and I heard that in February, and I heard it this trip too, and I'm not exactly sure what it's saying. I'm not sure if it's saying I'm looking for a fight, hey, I'm over here, ladies, come here, or it's saying, hey, make some noise so I can come find you.
Well, you called in some axes.
Yes, and I don't know. I wonder, get to see them.
Does an elk bugle to call in ladies?
I think it could work.
So I kind of feel like maybe similar with the axes,
you know,
too.
Turkeys do that. And not to go down the elk, or just like turkeys trip, you know, but...
You don't think?
I don't. but whenever you hear a turkey gobble, he's telling the hen to come to him.
Yeah.
That's why they come in so slow whenever they're, you know, you're calling to them. Because the hen's usually going to go to them, and you see that in person. And I think that's what was going on, because I was calling at these things. We got these little axis calls that you can blow on, and it sounds like one roaring. And I would hear one in the distance, and I'd do it. And I think Tyler did some of it too. And I did call in what I was more than one axis. They went downwind of me and were chirping around in the thick cedars. It was actually off the property that I could hunt. I couldn't go pursue them. They were on a different property. But they answered me and were chirping like it sounds like. This is how Michael described it. He said, it's like a cow elk, but just one note. Mm-hmm. So they don't ever drop. You know, a cow elk goes, mm-hmm. Axis is a meh, meh, like that. And they'll do it. If you hear it once and it's real loud, that means that Axis saw you or smelled you. If they do it a couple times and they have a little bit different pitch to it, that's them like calling and talking to one another. And I don't know what sound is what yet, you know, but I'd like to figure that stuff out. But, yes, I did call some in using the roar call, and I think it could be done.
Yeah.
The problem is whenever you go elk hunting, you are covering sometimes thousands of acres, whereas if you're limited to the property size and it's not very big, that calling stuff's only going to work so good. Mm-hmm. You can't just stay in the same place all day and call and try to make one come to you. I guess you could, but I don't know how effective it is. I did it and didn't kill one this trip, so that
well, in the rut, it could work. You
it
know?
Could.
But
what's the deal
know.
With the rut, man?
What do you mean, what's the deal?
Well, do you feel like it was...
Oh, I don't know.
The height of it?
Do you
feel
like
we were
behind?
Do you know
how many axis deer I saw on this trip?
As many as I did.
While I hunted? Yeah, zero.
So,
I mean, I can't tell you. I don't know. I mean... What we just witnessed was what looked like a buck, a doe, and a satellite buck at 11, you know, 11 o'clock a.m., just right next to the road. So, I mean, I would assume there's some sort of a rut going on right now, but it's kind of like hunting whitetails in East Texas where, you know, there's definitely like that elevated rut period of like 2 weeks, but outside of that, like, there's never just a full-on... Well, not never. Outside of that, there's not really a full-on rut rage, but you'll get some inquisitive deer knowing that something could be going on, right? Like,
uh-huh.
And so it feels like that. Like, I don't know when the rut is exactly. I've been told, like, pretty much when we're here. But
I kind of think – here's what I think was going on. And this is just taking my observations and trying my best, right? Because we don't know too much about this stuff yet. We're learning more. But I covered a lot of ground out here. I actually came out and put out alfalfa bales about 5 days before we went out to try to like chum up some axis and get some does around. And I believe that there is just one herd of does on this property.
Mm.
And if that group of does doesn't have anybody in estrus, then the rut is over on that property.
Yeah.
And I think that's what was going on. Whenever I went out and put the alfalfa bales out, I found some rubs, and I saw more rubs this time, and they all looked to be at least 3 weeks old. And I think that at least within that herd group that we were hunting, that everybody got bred or there's no does in heat when we were there. It all happened back in May. At least that's what I saw from the sign. You know, Greg saw a buck at distance a few times, and that buck was kind of cruising ruddy, and he always ended up going a different direction than our property because he was probably looking for some does that were in heat, and there were just none of those on our place.
I thought that this was going to be a great trip because
it was a great trip.
It was, but I mean, as far as like
hunting marks,
successful hunting goes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Greg, you were able to put out a few alfalfa bales for us ahead of time, and we had some. I had access like the second morning. I had a group of like five does, and I'm shooting whatever. If it's got red spots and it's bigger than 20 pounds, you know, I'm probably going to be shooting it.
Yeah, there is a scary little animal running around out there, in case y'all were wondering.
But they are very little.
Don't shoot any axis less than 15 pounds because you cannot discriminate between them and whitetail.
Yeah, they. I think I would think in July and August, things could get real tricky.
Yeah,
right?
Buddy.
But right now, those fawns are tiny. I was looking forward to this trip and thinking, we're fixing to kill some axis, man. I mean, we're going to at least kill a doe. We both had – you had a big buck on camera the first day.
Yeah,
had
like 4 hours after I was in there.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking, oh, it's going on.
Yeah.
Well, I can't believe I left, you know, or whatever.
I know. And then you had another buck like the day before we showed up or something. And, you know, things were promising. Then we show up, we go sit in our respective trees, we hang, sweat our tails off because it was so hot, and we're, you know, doing a hanging hunt.
And we hauled in another bale of alfalfa that day, too.
So we do that. We sit up in the tree, I don't know, 45 minutes before dark, we get a text. Greg says, guys, and then there's a picture of some limestone with a bunch of blood on it. And we were like, what in the world, dude? And so I thought he shot a buck. Turns out Greg was sitting on the ground self-filming, as he likes to do, and just had an axis doe by itself walk across this drainage, not even with the flow of the drainage, but straight across and up this like limestone kind of, not really a bluff, but it's a steep little hill. Just doesn't really seem like a place that it would naturally walk. And it does. Ends up 30 yards from him, and Greg self-films killing an axis doe. And, you know, it was just like, we were like, man, this is going to be good, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, if you want to make a long story short, over the next 4 days or whatever, we got about 5 or 6 hours of sleep every night, and you and I did not see another axis.
No, we didn't.
Or a axis, period.
Not on the property. We saw them driving around. And
I didn't even see that many driving around because, I mean, I didn't do a whole lot of driving. So
I saw a rut rager yesterday at 10:30 near where we saw him today, just cruising, like looking for does. And it's like it was frustrating and also like gave me some hope. Like, you know what? We're going to pull it off at the end, the very last thing. And we actually, Michael hunted with me, and we had a pretty good like setup. We had this field. So the property has got a couple corn feeders on it, and I think that the landowner might keep the one that's near us running because they can see it from the house, so they like to see deer. It only goes off in the mornings. And I've always heard and seen too that axis just don't eat a lot of corn. Well, we aren't seeing any axis, and finally, after a couple days, I was like, you know what? I'm going to put a camera on that feeder and just see. And sure enough, the first morning, there is a giant buck and two or three other bucks on that camera with some does just eating, just hammering down on the corn. Mm. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, that's the ticket. We're going to go set up near that feeder, and we're going to shoot some. And then we proceeded to do that three more times and never saw an axis. So the problem with axis is that they are highly streaky. And
they're
I think
streaky.
That's a thing like elk, like we were talking about. You can't really pattern elk too well. If you're going to hunt, if you've hunted wallow elk, then you know this, but you could hunt a wallow for 5 days and not see him, and then on the sixth day he'll be there.
Well, I kind of wonder if they're streaky all the time, or if the rut is also just amplifying that.
It could be.
Because there was definitely some streakiness when I was here, when we were here in February, but I had a pattern going where I was fixing to kill one and just kind of ran out of time and didn't have the right winds and stuff. I mean, so I don't know. These things are weird, y'all. They're somewhere between an elk and a white-tailed deer, you know?
Yeah.
And then also, potentially, I don't want to – this is another thing. These things get stereotypes, and people love to just communicate stereotypes instead of come up with some creative ideas. But, you know, I don't know that they're more, like, wary than a whitetail, but they sometimes seem like it. They may be. You know what I mean?
That's just – they just act different.
Yeah.
I mean, we got busted by whitetail does a lot this week, so I would say – that those are still very wary animals. So it's pretty hard to say, but I think axis are jumpier than whitetail. And I didn't get to experience it this go around, but the last go around, like, they just are like kind of like twitching all the time. Why do I think they're jumpy?
Yep.
Well, whitetail are made
in America
to avoid coyotes. Axis are made to avoid tigers.
Yep.
That's a pretty scary animal. And leopards and lions, too. All three of those big cats are native to the Indian subcontinent. So, axis are very much on high alert.
Well, there's not a whole lot more to talk about on the axis side of things, unless you got something. But I mean, we just didn't have a great trip on the axis side, but we did get out and do the fishing thing a little bit. And this is something that you and I have both done over the years. I kind of got into fly fishing in high school a little bit, but in college, I spent a lot of time tying flies and with the fly tying, just a cheap Bass Pro fly tying kit. Lefty Cray was the you know, guy teaching the how to tie some basic flies. And, man, then I started reading some books about, you know, places you could go and do this stuff. And I'm like, man, these are places I always wanted to go and shoot elk or whatever, hunt mule deer, but except I can afford it because it costs $30 to, you know, fish there for 3 days and, you know, some gas. And that, and I can camp anywhere, right? And you just get to go to these amazing places. So I started doing that in college and getting into it. And, of course, some of the easiest places that you could go that were really cool and fly fishable, that would be the Texas Hill Country, you know? I mean, just hop on 35 right there in Dallas where I was at and get down the road. And so that's, you know, I would say some of my first hill country fly fishing that I can remember was actually like on the Paluxy near Stephenville. And there, or I guess closer to Glen Rose, there's a Dinosaur Valley State Park there. I spent some time fishing there. It's water super skinny. And
yeah, that's tough, man. I feel like that water gets real hot late in the summer.
Oh, it does,
and stuff,
for sure, man. It does. But I was there, I mean, I'd be there all the time because I had, you know, Kaylee went to school in Stephenville. Later in her college, and so I had a reason to go there all the time, and I was going to take a fly rod with me. So kind of learned to fish clear, skinny water, which is what some of these places are. And we fished the skinnier side of the Guadalupe yesterday, man.
Yeah, we did. It was pretty tough for a bit, and then I kind of figured out a little thing and then kind of met up with you, and we kind of put our heads together to actually figure out how to catch some fish. It's really fun. And it's the thing that I get drawn into, to chunk a topwater and to try to get fish to eat a topwater.
Well, and I thought we were fixing to catch some green sunfish.
Yeah.
The first fish I caught was a green sunfish.
We did catch some. We didn't catch any biggins.
Yeah.
They were all small. And I think that was a condition of how much water. It's just a small part of the river. Yeah.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today. Because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
So, we want to catch fish on top waters, mm-hmm. and we were successful in doing that a little bit, but it was quickly becoming apparent that we were not going to catch anything that was worth eating on a top water. When I say top water, you know, some of y'all might know them as dry flies, but a lot of times in this Texas Hill Country stuff, you're using like a cheesy looking little fly made with some foam and some legs. It looks like a grasshopper or a spider or just something that things want to come up and eat, and you can pop them. And they'll make that chugga sound that sometimes makes bass come up, but I wasn't getting much of that. Did you ever have a bass try to eat that thing?
Not that I know of. I feel like that if a bass would have tried to eat it, he would have ate it.
Yes.
So they got a big old mouth.
That's a problem is there's like this little bit of a red herring, as they would say. When it comes to fishing, one of those things, you'll have panfish come up and splash it. And you're like, I'm getting hits, but I can't catch them. Well, it's because their mouth is tiny, mm-hmm. and they can't get a hold of that thing. So I swapped to some sort of beadhead hare's ear, I think, or something like that, and caught a little a little sunfish, and he was tiny and just couldn't eat it. So at that point in time, I was like, you know what? I need to tie on a big fly, try to catch a big fish, something that we can actually eat, because that was our goal. We wanted to kind of do the old surf and turf with Greg's Axis and a couple of you know, fish from the Texas stream, and it'd be kind of a fun little thing to do. Except I didn't want to have to eat them like sardines, you know, just whole. I wanted to be able to maybe fillet something or scale it and have something substantial to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So I tied on a conehead leech, which is pretty much a woolly booger, but it's made with a zonker strip, which is rabbit
not
fur.
Confused with a zonkey.
Not a zonkey. A zonker. So, and it's got a gold rib on it. And I believe what it ends up looking like is a helgramite. If you flip over the limestone rocks in these streams, there'll be helgramites, which are the larvae stage of a Dobson fly, which is a big, scary looking insect, but they aren't mean, but they have big mouth parts. You see them sometimes around the lights outside at night, but Dobson flies are a creature that lays its eggs in the water, and then a helgramite is a big long worm looking thing that's oftentimes black or like a dark gray cream colored thing, and I could take that leech pattern and cast it and strip it fast and get hits from Guadalupe bass, or I could hang it in the current. And they just, I don't know if it actually even looks natural, but they can't take it. They just gotta hit it. And then also you can dead drift it. I caught one on a dead drift as well. So, and I think that's when it looks like a Helgramite. But we've talked about this, you and I have, kind of maybe even off air, because there's some strategy to bass fishing and, like, the way that people go about it. You know, it's always been said on Lake Fork, where we grew up, that black and blue is the way to go, you know. And you can't really beat black and blue. If you're, or you might can beat it, but it's never a bad choice, I guess I'd say, for bass. And so, but I think it's a little bit, bass are strictly instinctive. They have a tiny little brain, right? So they're not saying, all I'm eating today is worms with blue tails, you know, like it's just not a thing that they think. So there's just some indicator to whatever the bait that you're throwing has on it that they say, that is prey and I'm going to eat it. And so I think that because that fly is black and they eat those helgramites, even though they've never seen a black leech or fish don't, or helgramites don't, like, hang in the current and they always dead drift, I think that those bass are just being like, that looks like something I've eaten and I'm going to eat it. And I don't think it says, like, you know how the match the hatch thing goes with trout?
Mm-hmm.
And it really is a thing. I mean, I've been in plenty of instances trout fishing whenever all the BWOs are size 16 or 18s and I got a size 12 and they will not hit it, you know, because it's too big. I don't think bass are really that way. Now, you can always do something to maybe make it a little bit better. You know, maybe they aren't hitting 8-inch worms. You need a 6-inch worm or something like that. But I think that that was the pattern that I got on, at least. And they were tucked up in tight up underneath the undercut banks and up under the stumps. You know, in Texas, there's really beautiful big old cypress trees, bald cypress that grows along the edge of these rivers and creeks. And that's where those bass were. They were tucked up real tight to those cypress stumps. And then once you figure that pattern out, you and I are able to hammer out a couple of these things.
Yeah. Yeah, it was fun. You know, I think that I kind of wonder about, you know, what you're saying there. I think that the way that a bass might be particular about the bait or profile would be when it is actively feeding.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's the case with most fish.
Yeah,
so,
that would make
sense.
So,
a trout that's actively feeding is going to continue to rise every few seconds or, you know, minute or whatever, mm-hmm. and just eat the stuff that is being offered, right? So, if you offer something that is different than what it's continually eating, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. Same thing with a trout that, or with a bass. Most of the time, what you're kind of referring to is, like, tapping into the ambush reactivity of a bass that may be sitting on a piece of structure, and you're trying to get him to just all of a sudden, like, whoa, what is mm-hmm. that? You know what I mean? Just
yep.
wake up. And then just snap at it real quick because it looks like something that I would eat.
And that's what those Guadalupe bass do.
Yeah.
Those things are fast.
Oh, they are, dude.
They are made to live in the current.
Yeah.
And they operate in fast water. Like, in fact, you probably aren't going to catch a guad in slack water.
Yeah.
That's not where they live. They mm-hmm. will be all up in, like, the running water, like in the Cascades. Mm-hmm. They'll be all in that stuff, like a trout.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And so that you are, man, you're kind of tapping into that. Those things are, you know, man, the first one I caught out of that pool that we caught three or four out of, mm-hmm. like, that thing had been eating everything in there.
It was a fatty.
Just dominating the whole run right there, mm-hmm. you know, and just so fat. So, but I kind of think, like, I don't know, it's the same thing with trout. Like, if you put on a woolly bugger of any sort and you make that thing get reactive all of a sudden mm-hmm. and chase, then all of a sudden it can't handle something that looks somewhat like it. Mm-hmm. But that same fish, if it was sitting in, you know, an eddy just sipping, you know, things that look like a 16 PA or whatever, then it's probably going to be a little bit selective in that manner. So I kind of wonder if fish aren't that way a lot of the time, you know. So maybe that's something that people can think about when they go fishing. But
yeah.
I know that, like, for us, you ended up kind of, we met back up, and we're fishing some pretty pressured water, right? On a Monday, there was people around fishing.
When you only got, like, 2 or 3 hours, you can't go to, like, the most remote stuff. You just got to go make it make it happen wherever you're at, you know? And that's what we were doing. And the idea was to go have some fun, too, and kind of cool off in the river. We've been hunting really hard. So, yeah, we were fishing the stuff that everybody fishes.
Yeah, and so it was you know, you had to put good casts in there. I broke a bunch of flies off because I was using a super light tippet because last time I had that rod out, it was catching big fish in a very high-pressured creek for trout. And so had to use a little tiny little 2.5-pound test, you know, or whatever. So anyway, you kind of give me this whole, like, man, I caught a guad back there on this leech pattern or whatever, or, you know, this black zonker, and maybe we should try throwing some bigger baits. And I was like, what do you think about this? This thing's heavy, sinks quick, but and it's kind of big. Is it too big? And you're like, no, man. And so I put that thing on, and we went downriver, and as soon as we got to a run, it was like, I literally was right next to him. I mean, I was 100 yards from my truck. My truck was, you know, 60 yards up the hill. So I was right next to the you know, where people would access the river.
Mm-hmm.
Caught a guad right off the bat on that bait. And I was like, man, this is going to be good, you know?
The fly fishing, especially in warm water, is not always the best thing to do. I mean, you know, it's kind of a, I don't know. I will never go to Lake Fork and be like, oh, the way to catch a fish is on fly, you know. Mm-hmm. But the reason fly fishing works in the mountains out west is because, you know, those fish are eating stuff up on top and the little lightweight things, and you can't cast that on a regular line. You mm-hmm. have to use a fly line, and it's practical. Well, in the Texas rivers, especially these clear water streams out here, it kind of gets into that a little bit. Now, you could maybe figure out a way to cast this stuff on some ultra lightweight tackle or whatever, but flies act different than other lures out there. Like Greg was using a worm, and he used a jerk bait that you had, a little tiny jerk bait, and he caught a couple fish on that too. But with that really heavy streamer fly that you were using, you were hitting a different water column that I don't know if anybody that is pressuring that thing is doing that. You know, if you have to fish pressured water, doing something different than what everybody else does is oftentimes a really good tactic because those fish just don't see that very often.
Yeah.
You know, there's you go to Lake Fork, where we're from, and throw a spinnerbait, you're going to catch a few fish, but those fish see a bazillion spinnerbaits. I mean,
I don't know if they do anymore.
They,
when we were growing up, they did. But I don't know if people use spinnerbaits anymore.
I've seen quite a bit of it. But you're right that there's less of them. There's chatterbaits, and people are doing all kinds of different stuff nowadays. You know, they're throwing A-rigs and, you know.
It's kind
of
like the crawl was big in the 90s, you know, and it, you know, nobody uses it now. They had the brush hogs in the 2000s mm-hmm. and those kind of things, you know.
That's my thing on Fork is if I have to go out there, I'm going to use a fluke or I'm going to Texas rig a worm because it's not something people really do a ton of. They do more flukes, you know, like, but a weightless fluke is a good way to catch fish. And in Texas rig, nobody has the patience to do it a lot of times. You know, people are trying to power fish. And when you slow it down with a Texas rig, that's a different,
animal. Yeah, for sure.
And so, and you can take this and roll it into hunting if we want to kind of mm-hmm. put a bow on this thing. Like, if you're hunting pressured stuff, like the public ground that we're all have to deal with in Texas, or maybe you're on a lease with a bunch of dudes, thinking outside the box can help a whole lot. You know, like, everybody and their dog wants to hunt in a tree. Well, get on the ground. You're probably going to fail a few times, but you might learn something, you know. And that's just one example. I don't know if you can think of some other stuff like that that's, like, out of the box.
We used to try to hunt the place that you had to open the most gates to hunt because mm-hmm. nobody wants to open a gate mm-hmm. and drive through it and then close the gate. So
another one that we actually have implemented recently that does work sometimes is, hey, instead of hunting deer right over the feeder, hunt 50, 60, 70 yards downwind of the feeder and shoot the deer when they come to scent check it because I watched does do this all week long. They didn't go that far out, but they would loop 30 yards downwind of the alfalfa bill and smell it every time. Mm-hmm. Even though they could see it plain as day, yep, they'd still loop down and smell it before they came in.
Well, I think it was 2 days ago when we set up on we had put a camera on a feeder that we found that was going, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, man, well, Casey had all those axes, so we'll go check this. We checked it. It was going. Put the camera up. And went in there the afternoon, and Eric and I are, like, walking in, and this thing goes off. And if you know anything about hill country deer, they don't waste any time going to that feeder sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so I was like, we got to set up. We set up real quick, real hastily, and we had a ghost blind with us. We had a doe come in, like, minutes, right, and had no regard to the wind. And I was like, okay. Then I'm sitting there like 5, maybe 10 minutes later, and look back behind us downwind. Kept checking back down this little lane, and there's a doe head, and she walks right in that lane and smells us up, you know, and ends up, freaking out. So I was like, all right, dude, we're just gonna have to scare this deer at the feeder, because we can't sit here all night. They're gonna keep doing that, and so we moved that, like, you know. In the middle of the whole thing, we move, and I think we ranged 90, 95 yards off the feeder.
Mm-hmm.
And every deer we saw, not every deer, almost every deer we saw came down that same lane, and if an axis would have ever showed up, dude, we would have just made it. It would have been awesome, dude. Like, it'd have been 15 to 35 and all just moving broadside to us.
That's pretty good shots.
Just off wind, dude. It was a good setup. We just didn't have any access. Yeah. So it didn't work.
We had good access. Not a lot of access.
Or as you call them, ascus.
Ascus. Well, guys, there's a lot of fun to be had, even though it's summertime. I know that was a lot of stuff to just kind of randomly talk about, but we just talk about our experiences, and hopefully you can learn some stuff about what we do, and we can all become better hunters together. So remember to get out with your family, have some fun this summer, and remember, this is your element.
Live in it.
Maybe you were born for a time such as this.
You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins. Hey everybody, listen up. I got mega huge news. Meat Eater Live is heading back out on the road. That's right. Join me and the crew. Clay Newcomb, Cal, Yanni, Spencer's going to be there. Phil the Engineer is going to be there. Meat Eater Live, headed back out. Now, when you get every ticket, okay, every ticket you buy, you get a signed copy of our new Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook. This tour is celebrating the release of the book. Buy a ticket, get a signed copy, Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook, wild game recipes for the grill, smoker, camp stove, and campfire, which I'll point out is a $38 value. Here's where we're going to go. April 23rd, the Mesa Arts Center in Mesa, Arizona. April 24th, the Balboa Theater in San Diego. April 25th, the Grove in Anaheim, California. April 27th, the Crest Theater in Sacramento. April 29, the Union in Salt Lake City. April 30, the Egyptian in Boise. May 1, the Wilma Theater in Missoula. May 2, the Bing Crosby Theater in Spokane, Washington. May 4, Revolution Hall in Portland, Oregon. And May 5, the last day of the tour, Pantages Theater in Tacoma, Washington. For tickets and more information, visit the events page at the Meat Eater.com. Hope to see you at the show.